Good morning, I'm Ralph T. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank the General Service Office for organizing this just incredible event. This is a little bigger than my home group, and wow, when I got outside. I'd like to especially thank the International Convention Coordinator, Eva Sanchez, for the loving invitation to share some thoughts with you today. My home group is the Dawn Patrol in Albuquerque, New Mexico. We meet every day of the year at 6:45 a.m. Come see us if you're in the area. Through the grace of my higher power, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and good sponsorship, I haven't had a drink since December 27, 1992. For that, I'm very grateful. You know, I love AA. As a friend of mine in my home group says, why wouldn't I love AA? It saved my life. My introduction to AA occurred between Christmas and New Year's in 1992. At that first meeting, I was welcomed by several people as I wandered back and found my way to the coffee pot. Walking in that room was very confusing to me. I didn't understand all the laughter. And, of course, I've turned to love that every day since then. I bought a big book that night. They told me I never had to drink again. And they said to keep coming back. You know, though I didn't realize it, I had experienced the common welfare that first night. These folks were helping each other. They were staying sober. And they seemed pretty darn happy. And I wanted what they had. Well, soon I learned more from Tradition 1, where Bill W.'s essay in the 12 and 12 says, quote, the unity of Alcoholics Anonymous is the most cherished quality our society has. Our lives, the lives of all to come, depend squarely upon it. We stay whole or AA dies. Without unity, the heart of AA would cease to beat. And he also said, it becomes plain that the group must survive or the individual will not. Well, my education and career has been in business, organizational theory, and information technology. And I wanted to know more about this AA society. You know, I didn't understand how the group could survive with no rules and no one in charge. How could the AA unity be assured? Well, in December 1947, Bill wrote in an AA Grapevine article, compliance or noncompliance with any principle of AA is a matter for the conscience of the individual. He is the judge of his own conduct. And he went on to say, the moment any action seriously threatens the common welfare, group opinion mobilizes to remind us and our conscience begins to complain. Well, I found a further clue in Tradition 2, which says, of course, for a group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. So the group conscience is where group decisions are made. Although I was just a small part of a great whole, I could not skip group conscience meetings and leave that to others. I was responsible for participating in the process of making decisions for my group. Well, at various meetings, I had heard things like, group conscience is the dark underbelly of AA. Or I'd heard that it was too boring or too long. But warts and all, I began to see that the group conscience process had evolved to be the mechanism where groups make decisions. In the essay on Tradition 2, Bill wrote, quote, on anvils of experience, the structure of our society was hammered out. Well, Bill's imagery reminds me of a blacksmith shop. You know, it's hot, it's dark, it's dirty, it's loud, and the work is exhausting, kind of like a group conscience meeting. In my experience, arriving at God's will, as he may express himself in the group conscience, occurs neither quickly nor easily. So what had I learned so far? Well, I'd learned that AA unity is the most cherished society the most cherished quality our society has. I learned that without the group, the individual may not survive. And without groups carrying the message of recovery, AA dies. I learned that through its decisions and actions, a group conscience contributes to the common welfare and hence AA unity. As a group member and a small part of a great whole, it is my responsibility to contribute to the common welfare by actively participating in all aspects of my home group. But as an individual member of Alcoholics Anonymous, how can I contribute to the common welfare of this worldwide fellowship? What yardstick can I use to ensure my actions as an individual give to the common welfare, not take from it? The 12 steps promise a spiritual awakening and daily sobriety contingent on a few things. But is there a similar process that guarantees my path will be aligned with the common welfare of my group and hence the fellowship? Well, we have those pesky 12 traditions. But, you know, the problem for me is when I quote a tradition, why is it often a negative response to something I don't like? You can't do that. It violates our singleness of purpose. If we approve that idea, we're not being self-supporting. Where are the traditions police when I really need them? Can I call New York? Certainly they would understand my point. Well, of course, we don't need a traditions police because we practice obedience to the unenforceable. But if I am to follow the traditions, why are there apparent conflicts and contradictions among these 12 spiritual principles? My group is autonomous, so why can't we accept the prison's offer to buy big books for our meetings there? Tradition 12 tells me that the spiritual substance of anonymity is sacrifice. But I have hundreds of friends on Facebook, and seeing a picture of my chip might plant a seed. Don't I own my anonymity? Well, in January 1955, the Grapevine published an article from Bill entitled Why Alcoholics Anonymous is Anonymous. And to me, that answered a lot of those questions and contradictions. Bill said, quote, "When the first AA group took form, we soon learned that each of us had to make willing sacrifices for the group itself, sacrifices for the common welfare. The group, in turn, found that it had to give up many of its own rights for the protection and welfare of each member and for AA as a whole. These sacrifices had to be made or AA couldn't continue to exist." Bill went on to say AA's 12 traditions are little more than a list of sacrifices that we must make individually and collectively if AA itself is to stay alive and healthy. Reaching a group conscience on anything is not without the expenditure of time and emotion. It is my opinion that one of the greatest gifts of active participation in the group conscience is the chance to use the traditions not as a weapon, but as a spiritual baseline. Sure, we have our history and our culture as a group. Sure, we have a few sacred cows. We have our bleeding deacons, and we have our elder statesmen and women. Just as AA works for most alcoholics, the traditions will work for most groups. Not only do we have the traditions, but my home group desperately needs them, and we must use them. I believe that what might be called contradictions in the 12 traditions are in fact intentional. Bill's gift was his knowledge of the alcoholic mind. Without paradoxes and contradictions, the traditions might seem like a lot of rules. It is often a struggle for a group to accept the traditions not as rules, but as spiritual principles. But this struggle, this journey, the group and the individuals must embrace sacrifice. And sacrifice is precisely what ensures our common welfare in AA unity. So what is my role as a home group member? For me, contributing to the common welfare can seem like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. Do I attend group conscience meetings? Do I pray before they start? It is my right to participate and vote at these meetings, but do I know it is also my duty? Have I told my feet? Am I clear that I'm but a small part of a great whole? On my own, I will not greatly help or hurt Alcoholics Anonymous. The daily reflection writing for January 31st says, "The whole is greater than the sum of the parts." Remembering that keeps me right-sized in group conscience meetings. Do I pay attention? Do I listen as if I have no opinion? Or do I miss the share because I'm busy building my response, starting with the words, "Yeah, but." Do I examine my motive before opening my mouth? If what I'm about to say is self-serving, then it is a bad motive, not in keeping with the common welfare. Do I treat group autonomy as a privilege to be respected and nurtured? Or do I use group autonomy as a battle cry for my ideas? If quoting AA literature, what is my motive? Do I offer passages in support of both sides? Or am I skillfully selecting the exact quote which, perhaps out of context, supports my position? Am I hiding a bad motive underneath a good one? You know, I wonder if the General Service Office in New York has a correspondence file called "Hello, New York. You won't believe what just happened." I'll bet many in the rooms today have seen letters from GSO beginning with, "On the one hand, you could do this, or on the other hand, you could do that." In my opinion, GSO's position on suggesting alternatives but giving no advice is the proper successor to the forge where the structure of our society was hammered out on anvils of experience. Now, I'd like to wrap up with three stories regarding the common welfare and the AA unity. My first home group was small. Our only service position was the treasurer, and he kept the money in a coffee can under his bed. For us, the spirit of rotation had to do with arranging the chairs in a circle. Group conscience was not scheduled, but was held when the treasurer said we had a little too much money in the coffee can, we needed to donate some to our central office. Now, without a GSR, this group did not participate in district or area events. There was very little of AA that I experienced outside of this group. Because the group did not participate in AA at large, common welfare and AA unity were just words that I heard when the traditions were read aloud. In my opinion, this story illustrates an error of omission. As a newcomer, I knew nothing of AA unity, let alone my responsibility in that regard. But it was a start, and I did not drink. The second story occurred some years later after I left my first home group. The story was told to me by a member who lived near a small town, and in that small town there were two AA groups. Men and women would attend one group or the other group, but never both. Competition and hostility between the groups was common. So what's wrong with this picture? First, I had never attended any meetings in that town. The story could be true, could be false, could be gossip. I didn't know. Second, upon hearing that story, I formed an opinion. Regardless of the veracity of the story, I had judged the groups, I had judged the town, I judged the individuals. Now, this story contains two lessons on my side of the street. First, perhaps the storyteller had made his own judgment of the groups, and it was woven into the fabric of the story that he told me. And second, when another person's story, when another person's judgment masquerades as a story, it is easy for me to inherit that judgment. For me, I wonder if an embedded judgment comes from the same character defects as a justified resentment. Nevertheless, as a small part of a great whole, the only criticism that I should ever make regards my own contribution to the common welfare of the fellowship. The last story occurred a while back in my home group at the time. That group held a group conscience every month. And one month, a member brought her daughter to the regular AA meeting, and they both stayed afterwards for the group conscience. The daughter had just been released from jail and had a few weeks of sobriety. And during the business meeting, the daughter voiced an opinion on most of the items that were discussed. I do not remember any of the business during that meeting. I do not remember any of the daughter's comments. I don't even remember the daughter's name. But I do remember thinking that she had minimal sobriety and no knowledge of the issues at hand, whatever they were. My character defect of judgment had made an encore appearance. You know, in the AA service manual, at the end of Concept 3, there are two sentences which I believe are fundamental to our common welfare and AA unity. Our entire AA program rests squarely upon the principle of mutual trust. We trust God, we trust AA, and we trust each other. That day at the group conscience meeting, I failed to trust the daughter, who had the same right to speak and to vote as everyone else. And I failed to trust AA, specifically the group conscience process. For me, sacrifice is a prerequisite for trust. Just as I had to trust my higher power in step 3, I must give up anything that begins with self. I must trust AA and its members. Without the trust, there is no chance that I will contribute anything to the unity of AA. And if I'm not helping the common welfare, then I'm hurting it. Well, in conclusion, I am responsible for contributing to our common welfare. My recovery depends upon AA unity. The only barrier to that is my own character defects. Hence, progress with steps 6 and 7 are vital to my recovery in AA meetings, in group conscience, in my family, and in the community outside of AA. Toward that end, there is something I have found very helpful in guiding my behavior regarding unity and our common welfare. It is the Traditions Checklist, first published by the AA Grapevine. The checklist is classified as service material from the General Service Office, and it can be downloaded from AA.org. You just go in and search for Traditions Checklist. Now, I'm going to take the last minute or two of my time here and close by reading the checklist for Traditions 1, which states our common welfare should come first, personal recovery depends upon AA unity. There are 10 items in this checklist. 1, am I in my group a healing, mending, integrating person, or am I divisive? What about gossip and taking other members' inventories? 2, am I a peacemaker? Or do I, with pious preludes such as just for the sake of discussion, plunge into argument? 3, am I gentle with those who rub me the wrong way, or am I abrasive? 4, do I make competitive AA remarks such as comparing one group with another or contrasting AA in one place with AA in another? 5, do I put down some AA activities as if I were superior for not participating in this or that aspect of AA? 6, and I am informed about AA as a whole. Do I support in every way I can AA as a whole, or just the parts I understand and approve of? 7, am I considerate of AA members as I want them to be of me? Number 8, do I spout platitudes about love while indulging in and secretly justifying behavior that bristles with hostility? Number 9, do I go to enough AA meetings or read enough AA literature to really keep in touch? And the last one, do I share with AA all of me, the bad and the good, accepting as well as giving the help of fellowship? Thank you for your time and your attention this morning.
Ralph, that was fabulous. Thank you for sharing. Now, I just recently met Deborah this morning, but she is a peach. She's actually from Georgia. So she's a Georgia peach. And please help me welcome Deborah.
My name is Deborah C., and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. My home group is a happy hour group on St. Simon's Island, Georgia. My sobriety date is September 16th of 1996. And I am truly honored and humbled to have been asked to speak with you today. When Eva sent the letter, she's a jewel too. It was excitement followed by, oh my God. And I want you to know that these opinions I'm about to express are my own and not necessarily the opinions of AA as a whole, because I'm very good at expressing my opinions, as the people that know me know. The first paragraph, and I'd like to just ditto what Ralph said. That was an excellent presentation. It was very good. The first paragraph of Tradition 1 in the 12 and 12 states, "The unity of Alcoholics Anonymous is the most cherished quality our society has. Our lives, the lives of all to come, depend squarely upon it. The autonomy of the individual is the power of AA. Every member has a right to act, talk, and think as he wishes. No one can compel a member to do anything he doesn't wish to do. The liberty of the individual is of the utmost importance, and to a newcomer, this liberty is verging on license, yet is recognized at once that AA, AA has the irresistible strength of purpose and action. It doesn't take long for the newcomer to understand that that strength is our common goal, our singleness of purpose." And the 12 and 12 goes on to say, "The AA member has to conform to the principles of recovery. His life actually depends upon obedience to spiritual principles. If he deviates too far, the penalty is sure and swift. He sickens and dies. At first he goes along because he must, but later he discovers a way of life he really wants to live. Moreover, he finds he cannot keep this priceless gift unless he gives it away. Neither he nor anybody else can survive unless he carries the AA message. The moment this 12-step work forms a group, another discovery is made, that most individuals cannot recover unless there is a group. Realization dawns that he is but a small part of a great whole, that no personal sacrifice is too great for preservation of the fellowship. He learns that the clamor of desires and ambitions within him must be silenced whenever these could damage the group. It becomes plain that the group must survive or the individual will not." When I first came to AA, I got here in 1982. And I started working the steps to see how selfish and self-centered that I had become and was. I didn't see myself as such. I was such a martyr. Look how much I sacrificed for all these people in my life. They didn't appreciate anything that I did. They just don't get how valuable I am, and I resented not having their admiration and respect. As I worked through the steps, I began to see the error of my ways and the distortion of my thinking. I began to see where I was responsible and where I was wrong. I was unraveling the confusion that was me. I didn't understand for a while what in the world the traditions had to do with my personal recovery. After all, it was still all about me. I thought the traditions were boring and they didn't apply to me. I thought they only applied to those in charge. I was learning about the principles of recovery and longed to possess these qualities. I don't know about you, but for me it was a difficult concept and idea to apply. I wanted to be tolerant and patient. I wanted to be loving and kind. I wanted to feel united with my family and my fellows, and it seemed like an impossible feat. But I was soon to realize that in order to learn that, I had to act that way. I had to act my way into right thinking by carrying the message and working with others. When I started sponsoring others, my character defects rose to the surface. For an alcoholic, being in a relationship is like putting Miracle-Gro on character defects. So I soon realized that the steps are what I needed to understand me, and the traditions are how I learned to get along well with others. I didn't play well with others before. It was usually my way or the highway, which explains how I became a serial marrier. The traditions are the roadmap to learn how to apply the principles of recovery, how to be able to practice these principles in all my affairs. The entire program is directed towards a higher power, a God of our understanding and the deflation of one's ego. It is an absolute necessity to set aside ego and look for guidance through the group conscience and our higher power. I don't know about you, but for the longest time, I had the ability to convince myself that my choices were God's will. Today, I know I have to be open-minded, honest, and willing to listen to others, to get guidance from trusted sponsors and friends, and especially the old-timers. As I mentioned, during the 80s, I did get involved in working with others, going on 12-step calls, sponsoring women, and I became a GSR of my home group. Life got better, as it usually does, when we do the next right thing. Unfortunately, after about 10 years in the program, I allowed others, not God, and sobriety to become the most important thing in my life. After 11 years of sobriety, I found myself drunk again. It was devastating. As they tell us in the rooms of AA, when we go back out, things never get better, only worse. And they did, very quickly. The really sad part of all that is that I knew what the solution was. I knew what the answer was. I knew where the help was. I knew what to do. And I could not do it. That false pride and ego almost killed me. It has probably killed more alcoholics than anything going. God saw fit to allow me to come find my way back into these rooms in September of 1996. And it was a tough, hard journey. And when I say I'm grateful to be an alcoholic, I mean that from the bottom of my heart. Because it has given me not one but two chances to live a better life. And to be of service to my fellow man. You know, sadly, my ego hurt a lot of other people in that relapse. I let people down. I had to make amends to these people by becoming a better person and a better member of AA, a better trusted servant. I tell people in my story that pain got me into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous the first time, but it was love that got me back. Because God in his infinite wisdom knew that the pain wasn't going to do it this time, and he sent two people into my life from nowhere, a woman and a man, and they were both raging alcoholics, and I was still drinking, and I started caring about these people, and I started trying to encourage them to go to AA. Sadly, Martha jumped to her death from a bridge about 6 years ago. Because she can never make it. And I don't know where the other fella is, but I know where I am today. Because when I started thinking of others instead of thinking of me, I was able to let God move back into my heart. And it's when God moved back into my heart that I was able to come back into these rooms. It's not, the lesson for me in all this is not to think about what I can get, but what I can give. It's not to be loved, but to love. And it's to live by the spiritual principles of the program to the best of my ability. We are a diverse and unique group of people. There's a lot of us that would not be friends out there in the real world. But we share a deep and common bond, the recovery from the disease of alcoholism. We all came in on different ships, but we ended up in the same boat. Tradition one, our common welfare should come first, is the foundation of all our traditions. Just as step one is the foundation of my recovery. If we were all physically in a boat, and there were a few that were intent on causing a ruckus and started rocking the boat, and it was in danger of capsizing, it would be up to the others to restore calm and prevent all from drowning. That is a really difficult part of this, speaking up when we see things that deviate from the traditions and the principles of recovery. Talking to an individual one-on-one or calling for a group conscience trying to resolve it or addressing the problem instead of denying it. One of the tools offered to us in AA is the inventory, personal and group inventories, and Ralph read the questions for Tradition 1. It's an invaluable tool to correct our path both personally and on a group level. If our group is one fraught with resentment and anger, or power struggles, or infighting, and a newcomer walks through the door and observes this, what do you suppose would become of that newcomer? Would they stay? Would they recover and be happy, joyous, and free? It's doubtful. Do we have a right to take away someone's life and future by not adhering to the principles of recovery? I have watched groups falter and fail from this very issue, and it's sad indeed. I have heard more than once about an individual looking for that first meeting or being from out of town and was in a tentative situation, and they go to the assigned meeting place and no one was there. That is my worst nightmare. And for those out there that are struggling, I am responsible for ensuring the health and duration of AA by doing my part. I had an Al-Anon sponsor once that gave me some wonderful words to live by. Mean what you say, say what you mean, and say it without being mean. That took practice. Without AA, I will not live. We will not live. I have proven that to myself beyond all doubt. The unity of AA is not unlike the unity in a marriage, for there it has, excuse me, for there to be harmony, happiness, and health within the relationship, it requires compromise, understanding, love, forgiveness, tolerance, and patience. It means making decisions and choices based on the understanding that there are consequences associated with all those choices, good and bad. It means checking my motives. Are they God-centered or ego-centered? Just as there is harmony in the home when these spiritual principles are used as a basis for getting along and growing together, so is it within the AA groups. I read a story one day about a certain type of birch tree in the western part of our country that grew very tall and bendable, but it had a shallow root system. If one grew alone, it was in constant danger of being uprooted and toppling. They grew in forests or clusters, and when hit with high winds or storms, they would sway and bend but not be uprooted or break because the other trees surrounding them would hold them up. That's what I think about when I think about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We need each other to stand. We need each other to hold us up when we can't be on our own. We need each other to weather the storm, and we need to remain united with our common goal always at the forefront and with God at the helm of our boat. God bless you, and God bless AA.
I told you she was a peach, didn't I? I'm even starting to talk with a little southern accent. This next woman I do know was honored, hope she doesn't mind me saying this, honored to serve with her at the 65th General Service Conference this April. And what a wonderful woman. And I'm really glad and happy to introduce Terry from Ontario.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Terry. I'm an alcoholic. And I am from Sudbury, Ontario, which is in Canada, Area 84. I belong to the First Step group, and it meets every Friday at 8 o'clock. And as I heard one of our prior delegates say, with or without me. And my sobriety date is December 26th, 1995. I have to, first of all, deal with my resentment at our previous two speakers. Yeah. I don't have anything written down. And I'm like, I'm a little like, I write great. You know, I seem to be able to write great, but I can't speak great. And it's like, now what do? I did write one thing down. It says, our common welfare, AA unity. I'm at the age, and apparently I also have the sign where I get forgetful. And I start talking, and then somebody or something interrupts me, and I don't remember where I'm at. So, I'm Terry. I'm an alcoholic. I, too, when I got the loving invitation, I didn't go woohoo at all. But I did print it immediately, and I stuck it on a corkboard, and I highlighted it. And then I ignored it. I don't like speaking. I'm not very good at it. I'm not very eloquent, and I can't quote anything. I am an alcoholic. When I did think about our common welfare, I know that I came in on the opposite of everything I learned in this program. So I thought, common welfare and the reverse of that is what's good for me. And that's what I practiced for the first 36 years of my life. And it was like, you know, get out of my way. I need that over there. And when I get that over there, I'm going to be okay. And then when I got that, it wasn't enough. And it never was. So I would chase that elusively, and it would be the next thing, and whether it was a job or a man or money or somebody who looked like they had money that I could marry and look okay and get better, and it never occurred to me to do things for myself, you know, like to go to school and get an education and look after me. I don't know why it didn't occur to me. I'm not entirely stupid. But there's some basic things that I just didn't learn. And it took me a long time. I had a sponsor finally tell me, if you weren't taught that, you'd never know that. And it was like, oh, okay. So I spent my formative years acting like I knew what was going on, dancing as fast as I can. I could not admit to not knowing something, and I couldn't admit to anything. I didn't know who I was. I didn't know what I wanted. Specifically, just generally, I wanted to feel well. I wanted, you know, to feel good. I wanted to feel like you looked like you felt. I used to just get blown away by the commercials for booze. Everybody was, you know, when they drank, they were happy and they all got along and they always well dressed. And I wanted to be that commercial. And you know, for all my supposed smarts, I didn't understand that that wasn't real. I got in a lot of trouble because even though I hadn't drank yet at, you know, 3, 4, 5, and 6, I was miserable, you know. I was angry and I was resentful and I got sent to my room a lot. And I was okay with that because I loved reading and I would get lost in my books, you know, and I would make sure they were thick. And I would cry when the book ended. I didn't like my life. And I hoped for the longest time that I was adopted and I would get rescued. And it never happened. And I never got rescued. I could never fake it long enough, you know, to get somebody to marry me and make me look okay anyways. And there's a lot of guys out there that should be thanking me, you know? So I've never been divorced. Until I got sober, I blamed my father for everything that was wrong in my life. And thank you. I'm a people pleaser too, Aisley. Oh, yeah. I was lucky when I was when I got sober. I got to make amends to my father, because I had always looked at what I didn't have, not what I had. And I always had a roof over my head. There was food on the table. I had clothes. And, of course, they weren't the food I wanted, the house I wanted, or the clothes I wanted. But I had them. And I got to tell him I loved him before he died. And he never found this program. And he was very, very angry and very, very lonely man. And he was me. And I could see that. So I was selfish, self-centered, self-seeking. And it wasn't working for me at all, at all, at all. Towards the end, I was drinking alone. I was going out to bars where I knew people would be that I knew, and pretending to wait for a friend that wasn't coming, and read the paper and have a drink and end up being friends with whoever was around. And it was a very, very lonely existence. And then one day I couldn't get out of bed anymore, and that lasted for about 3 or 4 months. I finally hit the program, and I tried to do the usual and just skirt around the outsides, and I was going to get through it quickly, and then I was going to go on about my business. And I got introduced to service work, even though I didn't know it, by shaking hands at the door and opening and greeting and making coffee. But I also tried to do that as little as possible. And I just found that the longer I was around, the more I ended up doing in service work, only because I couldn't find a good enough excuse to get out of it. And I'm very grateful for that, very grateful. I was GSR and alternate IGR. My partner and I belonged to a very small group, and every 2 years we would flip. He would be GSR and I would be IGR, and then we would be each other's alternates. So I got to go to a lot of service meetings, and from there I got involved in intergroup, and then I was secretary, and I was treasurer, and a couple of other positions, went to the district, and I ended up at the area. And the lower I went down that triangle, the more important I saw how our common welfare was important. I don't know. I chaired on service a couple of weeks ago at a meeting, and this gentleman followed me by saying that anybody who gets into service is just is saying, like, look at me, look what I'm doing. And I thought about that, because when people say things that give me a little, I got to look, because it's ringing true. And I'm pretty good at taking my inventory right now, or now. And I didn't see that. If anything, I found that it was the reverse of that. And I know that the purpose of service is to deflate my ego. And I was really, really surprised at that, to tell you the truth. I find that, as both of my predecessors were saying, that if we don't stand together, we're going to fall. And I love this program. People talk about, getting their life back. And when I think about it, I never had a life. So this is my first kick at the cat. And it gets better and better every single year. And it's just like getting over 40. Every year gets better. It really does. And I think one of the main things is that I care less about what you think. And I was told that it's none of my business what you think about me. So I'm good with that. I'm really good with that. I'm very good with that. Yeah. Because I'm not here to be liked. When I did stand for delegate, my sponsor is in the room right now. He says, do you want to be liked or do you want to be respected? And being who I am, I said both. And she says, you can't have both. And so I had to go for respected because the traditions tell me that, you know. And I'm not doing it to you as my friend. I'm doing this whatever's going on for the good of AA. This is what I've been taught, and this is what we need to do in order to stay who we are, to continue with our primary purpose. And, there's a lot of controversy with a number of things that are going on. But it says, carry the message, and the message is not what I think it is. It's what the big book says it is. And it's pretty simple, even for complicated drunks like us. That's like, okay. I think one of the reasons that I... one of the reasons I got up here today was my higher power. I actually believe that I'm going to be okay. And, I'm not going to die right here, right now. And I still feel like that, I feel like that when things come up. It's like that's the first place I go. I can't do that. And then I'm told, well, you let go, let God say a prayer, and you'll be okay. And every time I've done that, I have been okay and better than okay. Because, I'm not afraid to be laughed at or laughed with. And I never used to be able to do a lot of things because I was too afraid that, you would think I was an idiot or stupid or. And like I said earlier, it doesn't matter anymore. I'm doing the best I can. And I've had some really, really good teachers. And, they've told me and taught me and shown me more so, shown me exactly how to be and how to do. And I stand on the shoulders of giants. The people who first came around and they did the coffee and they did the ashtrays and they did, opening the doors and holding meetings with nobody there. And they wrote those books and they gave us that message, the message of hope. And they told me to go out and carry that message to the alcoholic who still suffers. And sometimes they're in the program. There are a lot of people that are in the program that are still suffering. And they just need to let go and do what's suggested. And it gets better and better every year. I swear to God it does. And it is great to be sober, and it's great to be alive. Every day above ground for me is a good day. I can't complain. And I get every day to choose how I'm going to be. And I choose sobriety, and I choose life. And I choose supporting this program with every breath that I've got. Because it's giving me everything I've got. So thank you for listening.